It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A common thread through the history of human spirituality is the idea that God or the gods created man and woman in his, her, or their image. But perhaps humans fashioned their conception of God as creator. This idea of deity possessing human characteristics and its implications is the topic tackled by religious scholar and author Reza Aslan in his most recent book, God, A Human History. He's speaking tonight at the Carnegie Music Hall through Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures. 90.5 WESA's Christopher Ayers spoke to Aslan ahead of his trip to Pittsburgh.
Your most recent book, God, A Human History, it discusses the human tendency to conceive of God in our own image, a sort of reverse engineering of the idea that God created us in his own image. How far back does this personification of God go?
Well, it actually predates our very species existence. Part of this has to do with the fact that the impulse to humanize the divine, if you will, is embedded in our cognitive processes. It's part of our human evolution. It's how the very idea of faith and eventually religion arose through human evolution. We are hardwired to conceive of the divine in human terms, to implant into our conception of the divine our own human attributes, to essentially make a God who looks and acts and thinks and feels just like we do.
And so it's not just like a physical old man in the sky type conception of God, but a being that possesses our emotional characteristics as well, our tendency to feel the same way that we do.
That's right. And it's interesting that you brought up the old man in the sky analogy, because that's certainly a huge part of how monotheism conceives of the divine. But I think one of the more interesting aspects of the book is it indicates how throughout the hundreds of thousands of years in which humanity has engaged in the divine and in all of its, you know, multiplicity, the concept of monotheism, the concept of a singular God, is barely 3,000 years old. But monotheism does just as much lend itself to this, let's say, involuntary impulse to humanize the divine as polytheism does. I think maybe a lot of modern contemporary people, whether they are people of faith or not, would say, well, okay, this is interesting. Reza's got a very interesting point. Certainly, you know, when we were polytheistic and we would conceive of the gods as each having a particular attribute, you know, the god of love, the god of war, the god of wine. That makes more sense, how we would sort of essentially divinize our personalities, divinize our attributes, and create a single god for each one of them. But nowadays, we're more sophisticated. We don't believe in a lot of gods. You know, we believe that there's only one god. We've moved beyond that. And the truth is that no, we actually haven't moved beyond that. We are still very much primed to think of a singular god as reflecting our values and our personalities, our vices and our virtues. And that, more than anything else, honestly, explains why two people of the exact same faith, who believe in the exact same God, who read the exact same scriptures, can yet have such profoundly different values, different morals when it comes to how they understand their religion.
So it's sort of this sense that religion is not something that's being dictated from somebody or something on high, but it's a reflection of the culture that that person lives in?
The culture and the sort of the individual, him or herself. I think it's important to understand that for the vast majority of people of faith around the world, particularly those who subscribe to a particular religion, it's a dialogue. It's a constant communication. It's not a one-way street. It's not that they are automatons being given instructions by their scriptures and then, you know, as though you're putting an algorithm into a computer and then the output is all the same. Obviously, I mean, just in the most common sense version of things, we know that that's not the case. It's a constant communication between the individual and that individual's scripture. And because scripture by itself is nothing more than just words on a page, it requires someone to interact with it. And the meaning of the scripture occurs precisely in that interaction. It requires an individual to interact with it. And then, obviously, that meaning is going to be affected by that individual's politics, that individual's gender or sexual orientation, or their social views, their economic views. All of those things go into how we define, interpret, and live out a religion.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Christopher Ayers, talking to author and religious scholar Reza Aslan. He's in town tonight for a talk with Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures. So you say that it's something that, you know, all religions, forms of spirituality have been susceptible to, this personifying of God, imbuing God with human characteristics. What are some of the drawbacks or some of the pitfalls you see of doing that?
Well, when we foist upon God our personality, our attributes, our likes and our dislikes, we create a divine being who has human characteristics, human personality, but no human limitations, right? What we do is we create a divinized version of ourselves. And that obviously has some very negative consequences to it. We basically take our likes and dislikes, our prejudices, our biases, our bigotries, and we foist them upon a being with supernatural abilities and no human limitations whatsoever. And in doing so, we construct a God who basically just becomes a divine version of our best and worst qualities. And then we are surprised when followers of that God find themselves in conflict, not just with other followers within their own religion, but with followers of other religion. Indeed, I would say that most of the conflicts, the religious conflicts that we see around the world, come precisely from this innate, involuntary desire to create a God who loves the things that we love and who hates the things that we hate.
So is it doing that, is that reflective of sort of our tendency towards narcissism in a sense?
Yes, and that has a huge part of why I keep talking about this as an involuntary impulse, as something that's embedded in the very workings of our brain. And so as a result, it takes an enormous amount of cognitive effort to kind of get rid of this humanizing impulse. I mean, throughout religious history, of course, there have always been great mystics and thinkers, prophets, people who have warned us against precisely this kind of humanizing impulse, who have defined God in terms that eschew human attributes and human characteristics. And I think that that's still a path that's available. By the way, for both people of faith and people without faith, make no mistake, atheists find themselves creating this exact same problem. I mean, oftentimes when I ask somebody who tells me they don't believe in God, my follow-up question is, well, what do you mean by God? And what I've noticed is that people who don't believe in God and people who do believe in God make the same fundamental error of talking about God in distinctly and explicitly human terms.
As someone who studies religion, faith, I'd just like to get your perspective on the current state of religion and faith in America and its intersection with public and political life. Why are white evangelicals so into Trump is basically what I'd like to ask you.
Listen, everybody's asking that question and trying to figure it out. 81% of white evangelicals voted for Donald Trump. That is a record. That's more white evangelicals than voted for George W. Bush, who was himself a white evangelical. But I do think it's important for your listeners to understand that 67% of evangelicals of color voted for Hillary Clinton. People who hold the same beliefs, the same values, read the same scripture, hold the same theology, but who have a different skin tone. And so if we are going to talk about the enormous support, the historic and unprecedented support of white evangelicals for Donald Trump, and we are not going to talk about it in terms of race, then we are lying to ourselves. More importantly, however, it has accelerated a process in the United States that has already been going on for quite some time, which is a turning away of traditional religious labels and institutions, and towards what the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life has begun to label the non-affiliated. If you were to ask me to simply take a snapshot of the American religious landscape right now, the most fascinating aspect of what's happening in America is not the sort of slow, steady decline of Christianity, which has been going on for quite some time. It's the surge of the so-called non-affiliated people who, to put it in, you know, sort of colloquial terms, are spiritual but not religious. These are people who have rejected religion for one reason or another, in large part, I would have to say, because of the way that religion has been adulterated by politics. But more importantly, these are people who refuse to call themselves atheists, refuse to say that they don't believe, but who don't want necessarily their beliefs, their spirituality, to be hindered with a particular religious label. In the last Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life polling on American spirituality, nearly one quarter of Americans now define themselves as non-affiliated. And it is growing at such a rapid pace that we are not even equipped with the tools necessary to, I think, properly examine, analyze, and comment on this movement. I know a lot of my colleagues who study new American religions or new religious movements are only now starting to really wrestle with what this is, what this means for the future of American spirituality. But we are in a place now where a quarter of all Americans and two-thirds of all millennials call themselves spiritual but not religious.
Reza Aslan is a religious scholar. He's the author of God, A Human History, which is out now in paperback. You can hear him tonight at 7:30 at the Carnegie Music Hall in Oakland through Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures 10-evening series. Reza, thanks for making time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Christopher Ayers. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Ferguson Mine in Connellsville, Pennsylvania, explodes in 1903. About two dozen workers were trapped in the coal mine when it suddenly exploded, causing the roof to cave in and flames to shoot through different rooms of the mine. Nine men were able to escape from the pit's mouth, but the others were unable to get out in time. Investigators believe gas seeping into the space was the cause of the explosion, although none had been reported earlier that day. The mine had been set to close in 6 months. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Above the northern bank of the Allegheny River overlooking downtown, a group of residents has spent years trying to make their little corner of Pittsburgh a better place to live. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook has more on Troy Hill Citizens.
Removed from the bustle of the city's busier neighborhoods, Troy Hill is a bit off the beaten path. But looking out from the hillside is a breathtaking view of the Pittsburgh skyline. Family businesses and mid-sized dwellings dot the streets where residents have forged a close-knit community with a small-town feel, a neighborly characteristic that exists thanks in no small part to a group of residents that got together decades ago.
It's just kind of started as the neighborhood nonprofit organization to work between city council with all the different departments of the city, and that people living in the community have someone to go to when they have an issue or have an idea for the community.
That's Patrick Duffy, the vice chair of Troy Hill Citizens, an organization that aims to increase participation in neighborhood programs, develop camaraderie, and beautify the area.
That's a big push for clearing off the steps, for planting flowers along that major entranceway, you know, mulching some areas and planting flowers, planting trees.
Duffy says with its population of about 2,700, it's crucial community members take ownership over how the neighborhood looks and how neighbors interact.
A lot of the time we're looking towards the people power that we have here, not necessarily, you know, relying on the big dollar grants that in the past we may have gotten, but, you know, as funding becomes tighter and tighter, these are harder to get. So I think you do have to rely on being more creative and relying on the people you have to kind of solve the problems that are your own.
One way the group works to strengthen the connection between its residents and the larger community is by encouraging renters to become homeowners. Through its real estate program, Troy Hill Citizens works with the Pittsburgh Community Reinvestment Group to purchase properties, then resell them to buyers. Troy Hill Citizens Chair Sam Morris says a preference is given to existing community members who are currently renting their home.
We're able to get these properties at a very small fee, usually a couple $1,000s, and we're able to sell those to preferably people that are in the neighborhood in order for them to build some equity.
Morris says the program serves a twofold purpose, putting homes in the hands of residents with an interest in keeping up and maintaining their homes, and helping residents who want to put down roots to do so, ensuring the neighborhood a more stable future.
The preference is given to people that live in Troy Hill, that are familiar with Troy Hill, and that are they're contributing to the neighborhood actively. We'd like to be able to, you know, build this kind of internal economy.
For Vice Chair Duffy, the beautification projects and real estate program are examples of what neighbors can do when they simply come together around a common goal. And that by working through Troy Hill Citizens to make the neighborhood more livable, community members are honoring the work of those who came before.
None of this is really possible without all the hard work that's been done before, you know, we got involved. This has been going on since the 1970s to put work back into the community to make this a place that people want to stay, want to live.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Machine learning is an integral part of Pittsburgh's tech economy. Carnegie Mellon University is one of the nation's foremost research centers in that field. And that's enticed tech giants like Google and Uber to set up shop here. But what is machine learning?
I've heard of it, but I don't really know what it is.
It's when you train a computer, for example, or a program to optimize something or to automatize something.
It's like applied statistics used for understanding basically how patterns can get recognized.
That was Karen Abruzzo of Oakland, Adeline Mercier of Squirrel Hill, and Alex Hsu of Oakland. For our occasional series, A Moment of Science, CMU professor Tom Mitchell breaks down what machine learning is and why it's important.
Machine learning is part of computer science, and it's the part of computer science that has to do with the question, how do you make computers improve automatically with experience? Humans are the best learners we know, much better than machines are these days. But the idea is similar. For example, if you learn to play chess, you start out knowing the rules, but you don't know the strategy. And you make mistakes, and you learn from those, and you become better. One of the reasons that machine learning is so popular these days is that there are some things that it's really hard to write a computer program for by hand, but you can actually do it instead with machine learning quite easily. Face recognition is one of those. So for example, we all know how to recognize our mother in a photograph, but nobody in history has ever succeeded in writing down the detailed algorithm for recognizing their mother. But today, it's very easy to train a computer program to recognize your mother by showing it photographs, and you say, this photograph, here's my mother. This photograph, my mother is not in this one. If you can give enough of those training examples, then what machine learning algorithms do is they look at the details and they find what's common to the positive examples that distinguish it from the negative, and you can train a program very accurately to recognize your mother. I think we're going to see more and more applications of machine learning to more and more parts of our life. Right now, machine learning is mostly statistical in nature. You have to look at thousands or millions of examples to learn those regularities that let the machine learn. But if you think about how humans learn, we learn in so many different ways that machines don't yet. For example, we learn by having conversations. And now that we have systems like Siri and Alexa and Google Home, which we can have a conversation with, I think you'll be able to teach those systems. I think in the future, you will be able to use your Alexa or your Google Home by saying to it, that sound you just heard was my dog barking. And whenever my dog barks and you don't hear me respond because I'm not home, then I want you to say in my voice, it's okay, Fido, calm down. But I think in the coming decade, we'll be able to teach them the same way you would teach me to do something if I was your assistant.
That story was produced by WESA Tech reporter Kathleen Davis. Find more stories from our Moment of Science series at our website, wesa.fm. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Mary Lou Williams was a creative genius and Pittsburgher, responsible in part for pushing the genre of jazz into new directions over her half-century-long career. Jazz pianist Deanna Witkowski has been spending time in Pittsburgh researching Williams for a new book, Mary Lou Williams, Music for the Soul. Witkowski sat down recently with 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker.
So you wrote that for Mary Lou?
I did. I wrote it when Dr. Billy Taylor asked me to play at the Mary Lou Williams Festival in 2000.
The Women in Jazz Festival,
yes.
Each year at the Kennedy Center?
At the Kennedy Center. And that tune, I wanted to show Mary Lou's harmonic openness, her adventurous spirit, and her rootedness in the blues.
First of all, Deanna, thank you very much for taking the time to come in and talk about a subject that I've been fascinated with for decades.
It's a pleasure. Anytime I can talk about Mary Lou Williams is an honor for me.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. She was unique in all of the history of jazz. Let's talk a little bit about some of her early music. She was ahead of her time, no matter what time it was. With Jeanette's Cinco Jazzers in 1927. Mm. She was 17 years old and already a professional musician. She had been earning money as a professional musician in Pittsburgh long before she took off as a teenager. And shortly after that, she found herself with bandleader Andy Kirk, where they had great success, all built on Mary's composing and arranging and her piano playing. And what I've read, I got the impression she drove them to their gigs too. She did everything for them. She was the reason that band existed. I mean, the band existed before her, but she was the reason that band had success.
Yes.
She played in a way that was different from other pianists of that era.
Because she was absorbing from different people, but she always had this way of synthesizing all of the music so that it just came out differently. Her style really evolved a lot, you know, as opposed to some some musicians, like, you know, if you hear someone like Louis Armstrong, you can totally tell it's him, right?
Perfect example. He did what he did for his entire career. And no reason why he shouldn't. Because,
totally. Yeah. But she was an experimenter. I mean, and she talks about this. She says, you know, she was always like during the bebop era, she was not only, I would say, learning and being influenced by other bebop musicians, she was influencing them.
She, in fact, is often by historians referred to as the mother of bebop because of the mentoring she did to Dizzy Gillespie and Bud Powell.
She really wanted to create music that was new, like all the time. So whatever form that took, I mean, at one point she did a record where she just called it modern music because that's what she felt the jazz should be.
Yeah, Duke Ellington called her perpetually contemporary. Here she is in 1945 from her Zodiac Suite. I'd like to ask right now, before we go much further, what is it that ignited the passion in you to write a book about Mary when there have been a couple of books already published?
Sure. Well, the book was actually not my idea. So I was approached by a publisher called Liturgical Press, and they're a Catholic publisher. They have a biography series meant for general readers, and each of the volumes, the subject is someone who was Catholic at one point or another in their life, and that's a huge part of Mary Lou's story, starting in the late 1950s, when she converts to Catholicism, then sacred music, composing liturgical music, becomes a big part of her life. So I've been playing her sacred music for many years, for decades now, and finding out more about relationships she had with people that really kind of influenced her for like the last 20 years of her life is a big part of what this book is going to be about that's not so much in the other two biographies.
Okay. What first drew you to Mary's sacred music?
Well, I would say that the way that she sets text. The way that she could involve community choirs in doing her music and not relying on all professional musicians is a big thing that drew me to her music. That's something that I also do a lot. I work in churches doing original jazz music all the time with people who are not professional musicians.
A matter of accessibility.
Right. And it's also like spreading, you know, it's making the thing so that jazz is not just something that only certain people can do or can access. And I really think that was part of Mary's mission, and that's really part of my mission too.
When you said yes to the request to put a book together about her, what was your process? What did you do first?
The first thing I did was go back to the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, which is where most of her archives are housed. So I had already spent time there over the years, but the first thing I did was go to boxes of letters, probably five huge boxes, hundreds of letters that were written between Mary Lou and different women religious, like nuns, who she met on retreats that she went on in upstate New York. I mean, there was one Sister Martha Mulligan, who was a Cenacle sister, and the two women, from what I can gather, they wrote each other like twice a month for 10 years.
Wow.
It's amazing how they really kind of sustained her. I mean, because you can tell that they're both sharing really deep personal things.
At this point, it's probably good to portray how Mary became a Catholic, when she converted to Catholicism.
Sure.
After it was a life as a professional musician, which can and often is very tumultuous. As an African-American woman in a man's world and in a white-dominated world. There were things that she dealt with that other people didn't have to.
Right.
And ultimately, she found comfort and solace and redemption in Catholicism. Can you give me a little bit of a brief thumbnail sketch of how she came to Catholicism and what she did in the first few years after converting?
Sure. So Mary Lou was someone who, when she knew that she needed to do something, she did it. And that often meant that she left situations. That meant that she left the Andy Kirk Band in 1942. She says she walked off the bus, you know, with her suitcase. She walked off a recording session with Benny Goodman in the late 40s when they were kind of having a spat. And she says she walked off a stage in Paris in 1954 when she was having her closest friend in Europe, Garland Wilson, another pianist who she shared sets with, had just passed. And so she left and she said she didn't know if she would ever go back to music. What had happened right before she had gone to Paris was she had been at a party and someone noticed she was kind of depressed and said, you know, what's going on? And they basically said, go read this particular psalm, the 91st psalm. So she started reading all the psalms. There's 150 of them. They're all like short poems. And somehow between that and also in silence, she started going to this garden to meditate in Paris. She had a vision of the Virgin Mary. And those were kind of the beginnings of her search in Europe. She comes back to America after 2 years in Europe and starts just searching for somewhere to find other people that she can like be with in a church. She goes to Abyssinian Baptist, where Adam Clayton Powell Jr. was the pastor, and that was super politically engaged church, and it was kind of too much for her. So she tells, you know, the New York Times critic John S. Wilson that the only reason that she started attending a Catholic church was because it was the only church that was open in her neighborhood, a few blocks from her apartment in Harlem. And she felt such a need to pray for other people that she had a list that she would write on scraps of paper. It grew to 900 names. And she had this belief that she had to pray for every single person individually every day. So she was spending like between 5-6 hours in church every day.
From other sources, I understand a part of her nature was reaching out to help people who she felt needed help. She did a lot of different things. The thrift store, where she would literally give away clothes to people who couldn't get clothes in any other way.
Right.
Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, I love, there's this one documentary from like the 80s about Mary Lou called Music on My Mind. And in it, she says, like, you know, I'm like a big bear and you just tell me somebody who needs help and I'm just going to go out there and help them.
So it's safe to say that she was a spiritual person long before the conversion to Catholicism.
Yes.
The conversion was just that spiritual aspect of her nature just coming to fruition. So to circle back to the idea of putting a book together about this particular aspect of a woman whose career spanned the entirety of jazz, and she was often the catalyst for moving jazz in a new direction, and then other people would follow her, and then she'd go off into another direction of her own. But you're writing a book that will primarily focus on the sacred music?
The book is really meant first and foremost to be an overview of her life and her music. So I am taking music from Andy Kirk all the way through zoning in 1974.
She was the hippest, most modern person making music then, just like she was 50 years before.
Yeah. And I've really, really had to think about what are the key moments that I need to bring out.
Let me ask you briefly about your experiences here in Pittsburgh and the time you've spent here researching.
I love Pittsburgh. more than anywhere else I think I've been in the country, I have just found musicians here, I mean people in general, but really musicians, to be so welcoming and so encouraging. And I, as soon as I tell people I'm writing a book about Mary Lou Williams, like yesterday I visited a church, I went to St. Benedict the Moor, and this older woman came up to me and she said, I knew Mary Lou Williams, and she started telling me stories. And people want her story to be told and they want to know her story more.
Yeah.
So just being able to be here and to talk to people about her and learn, put myself in a position of just being a learner is just a privilege.
And what you've learned will be in a book. And tell me the title.
Yes. So the book will be called Mary Lou Williams, Music for the Soul, published by Liturgical Press. And we think the tentative street date is January of 2021.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, me too.
Deanna Witkowski, thank you very much for taking the time and talking about, as I said, a subject that I am completely mm-hmm. fascinated by. In an art form that has produced a lot of unique characters, she stands above all others to me.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk about Mary Lou Williams.
Give us this day.
That was jazz pianist Deanna Witkowski speaking with 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. And joining me now is Chris Potter, the editor of WESA's government accountability team. Chris, about a year ago, Amazon announced that its second headquarters would be split between New York and Northern Virginia. Well, that changed not long after, but as something of a consolation, the company also promised more jobs in Pittsburgh. A $30 million fulfillment center is in the works, but all is not well in Findlay Township, you report. Why?
Yeah, so once again, it seems as though local hearts being broken by sort of disappointed hopes in Amazon. Last week, Darren Kelly, who's the top AFL-CIO official in southwestern Pennsylvania, issued a statement just blasting Amazon for not hiring more local workers and local companies to actually build this facility. It's about, as I think you said, a $30 million facility. Mm-hmm. And he says, look, a lot of companies here locally are just not getting work helping to build this plant. They're using out-of-town, out-of-state labor.
Has that been confirmed that these workers are from out-of-state?
Yeah. So, I mean, I talked to the guy who works for the developer that Amazon hired to do this stuff. And he says, look, right now, if you go onto the job site, there's only a couple of the contractors working there. They are from out of state. But that's not to say that they all will be. He says that they've hired something like eight subcontractors that they have under contract. They may not be working on the site yet, but they're slated to go on the site with more jobs in the future.
How many jobs are we talking about total in terms of construction? Is there a hard number yet?
There's not one that I was able to get last week. Kind of these guys kind of come and go as different projects sort of happen. The center itself, once built, is supposed to employ about 800 people working as fulfillment workers, kind of getting stuff off the shelves and schlepping it
right.
and getting it to your door.
All right. So the construction jobs, union, non-union?
A mix. Mm-hmm. A mix. And apparently what the company says is we have hired, of the eight firms that we hired locally, there are some union and some non-union.
Did you get a response from Amazon to this criticism from unions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Amazon said, look, we like to work with local folks, but we also have these projects. These are big projects. This is a million square foot facility. There's obviously a lot going on in Pittsburgh right now. And what the developer said is we have to be really careful. Like we need people who are a certain size and have a certain capacity. We also need to be really competitive on price because that's what Amazon demands from everybody who does business with it.
So you got a statement from Amazon, but you also talked to the developer Hillwood, didn't you?
Yes, that's
right. What
did
they tell you? They're from Texas.
Yeah, they're from Texas. This the Hillwood guy I spoke to seemed very surprised that this had played out this way. Hillwood has done other projects for Amazon, including a fulfillment center in York, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I thought this was still Pennsylvania. He just sort of represented to me that he did not see this coming. And he sort of ascribed it to the fact that, you know, Amazon is a really easy target.
Could this be on Pittsburgh? Do we have enough workers here to fill the need?
Yeah, if you asked Darren Kelly that, he would pound the table and insist that, yes, we absolutely do. I think maybe what's going on here is that there is a desire to sort of have a shot across the bow at Amazon and anybody else that if you don't hire local folks, you can expect some blowback. And this message has gotten picked up by Democratic office holders from Bob Casey and Tom Wolf all the way down.
All right. We have just 30 seconds left. So could this all be kicking up some dust? Affect the hiring, you know, at least in the short term? Do we know if it'll get Pittsburgh more area folks because of these complaints?
I don't know that it's likely to happen with this particular project. A lot of the work has been let out. But as I say, there is another Amazon sort of satellite facility that they're already talking about also in Findlay. And there's other work that's coming along as well. And this may be about sort of pressuring and putting the pressure on the front end so that future projects do retain more local workers.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, they are currently the most successful team in Pittsburgh. We'll visit with the coach and members of the Pitt volleyball team, ranked second in the nation. And this holiday tradition has brought smiles for generations. The Miniature Railroad and Village is celebrating its centennial. Today's program was produced and engineered by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.